sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
It was the weakest job report in over 5 years. Or was it? OPEC meeting ends without any action. China's yuan approaches a five-year low. And our guest today, Ben Hunt of Salient and the author of Epsilon Theory. All this and much more on episode number 465 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to June. Andrew Horowitz here, and I am the host, of course, of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Also, you can hear me each and every week with John C. Dvorak on DH Unplugged. Last week, I took the week off. It was Memorial Day. We had a big party at the house, a crawfish boil, lots of things going on in Florida. It was hot. I mean, it was really hot. Kind of that hot that just stays on you all day, that sticky and humid and kind of just can't get away from it kind of hot. But we had a great party. Brought in about 60 pounds of crawfish. A friend of mine actually came in from Louisiana. He drove all night, brought all his gear, his pots, his flames, his stirrers, his sauces, his spices to help put those crawdads into the pot and get them all spiced up, ready to eat. It was a fun time. Kind of takes a little bit of a little process to cook them, but the outcome is always just great. Great time of year. Summer's beginning. Hope you're enjoying your Memorial Day start of the new year as well. And we did have some really interesting things that happened over the last few days. We saw that while it was a holiday shortened week for the U.S. markets, we did see that, well, there was a bit of a stalling. And some of that was due to the fact that Friday's numbers were a lot less than anticipated in terms of the employment report. In fact, it was the weakest job report since, well, 2010 or so. And there was only 38,000 jobs added to the payrolls in May. Now, to be fair, some of that was due to the Verizon strike. About 35,000 was due to the people that were no longer working, or at least on strike at Verizon. But we also saw that in March and April, there was a reduction of gains overall. About 50-plus thousand people were taken off of the overall payrolls that was added. So the average on a three-month basis now has dropped to about 116,000 new jobs added. Now, estimates were for about 155,000, 160,000 or so new jobs added for the month of May. And the unemployment rate was estimated to be, I guess, at about 5.1%, depending on what analyst and economist you looked at. But what was really kind of interesting was that while we had this really weak payroll additions number, we saw at the same time that the jobless rate, the unemployment rate, dropped to 4.7%. Now, part of that was due to the fact that about 450,000 people left the overall job market. The labor participation rate dropped about 0.6% in May. So therefore, it kind of skewed the numbers a bit, but nonetheless, what's really interesting and what we're going to have to watch now is while all of the commentary, the way the markets traded, the currencies traded, the dollar dropping 1.5% against a basket of currencies, the yen rising almost 1.8%, the euro 1.5% on a rise. So there's a lot of commentary about how weak this number was in terms of the new jobs added. On the other hand, we're seeing that the unemployment rate, which is the focus supposedly of the Fed, dropped to lows we haven't seen since 2007. 4.7% is essentially full employment in the U.S. So now we have inflation ticking higher. We see that oil is moving up. We see that we're seeing signs of some inflation. We're seeing that the unemployment rate has now surpassed the target to the downside, in other words, beyond their expectations of about 5% for the Fed. Now we see that the anticipation for a rate hike in June, which was about a 20% chance, 22% chance that that was going to happen before this report was put out, has now dropped to only 4%. So the idea of a rate hike in June is off the table by market participants, which is kind of weird because we are seeing some of the numbers much better here. The Fed has been talking about rate hikes the last few weeks that probably is going to be happening, do it sooner than later. July dropped also, the estimate of probability in July dropped tremendously also for a quarter point rate hike. So I got to wonder what they're thinking the Fed is going to do here after all this talk about the economy getting stronger, at least moderately stronger, jobs gains coming in, inflation ticking higher, all the things they want to see here. And now we saw, well, probably not going to happen. I find it really fascinating that this is really going on because, again, if you didn't know anything and you were just looking at the numbers and being quote-unquote data dependent, right? That's what the Fed talks about all the time, being data dependent. Then the nuances behind the jobs number of how many were added or not really shouldn't come into play. The statistics and how they calculate these numbers are what they look at. And that's what they said they're going to look at. But at this point, we did see that there was a significant rally in bonds. We saw that the 10-year ticked down to about 165 at some point on Friday. Markets took a swoon early on, recovered a lot of it with the thought that, well, yeah, it is bad. And when you combine that with many of the other statistics that have come out recently, it doesn't look like we're really in a growth phase here. GDP is flat. Manufacturing is not so great. Factory orders, et cetera, not so great. Earnings, clearly an issue. But you know what? Well, good news. Maybe the Fed's going to stay on hold for a while. We saw the consumers actually did a little bit better in terms of their spending throughout April. The report showed that there was about a 1% increase in April. Nothing to be excited about, but better than expected. Personal incomes were also up a bit. We also saw that the manufacturing number moved above 50 for the first time in a little while in May. Some growth there. And we did see that the service sector, which was the major part of our economy, dropped down to 52.9, about 2.5 points. Consumer confidence dipped a little bit too. And by the end of the week, the NASDAQ was up about 0.8%, clearly the one that was lagging this year so far. The Dow was pretty much, Dow and S&P were kind of flat for the week, nothing exciting at all there. Upcoming this week, we have a discussion and a talk, a speech by Janet Yellen on the economy and monetary policy on Monday, and not much in the earnings, kind of winding down the earnings season. We have some things like Casey's General, Thor Industries, Tuesday, Michaels, Verifone, Wednesday, Lululemon Athletica is coming out. We'll see how their turnaround is going on. Thursday, we're going to be seeing initial claims again, H&R Block, JM Smucker, and Friday, we're going to finish off with University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Index on Friday. So not a lot of data points to be really looking at this week. We did see that last week also Mario Draghi came out with some commentary that said that they're not going to really be increasing or decreasing or doing anything other than what they anticipated. Nothing new added to their stimulus program. And he did also admit that, well, just to let you know that a lot of the stimulus we've done so far has really not seen a lot of reaction in terms of growth for the markets. Kind of an admission that what they're doing isn't working. We also saw the OPEC meeting. Kind of interesting. There was a rumor floating that OPEC would come out and start talking about a production cap or a production ceiling, I guess, at this point. And of course, by the end of the meeting, nothing was agreed upon. Nothing happened. So they're doing a great job, OPEC, of managing the rumors and putting the carrot out there to keep oil prices higher. And we're still approaching that around number 50, which seems to be significant resistance on the price of WTI crude. A lot of rigs had been dropped, production lowered, so about a 9% decrease in production over the last year. But yet on Friday, when the Baker Hughes rig count came out, which is the number of rigs that are actively working, there has been a continuation of the drop of rigs. Just a tremendous amount of rigs are offline. The first time in a while we've seen actually a restart and two or three rigs came back online net. So we have a reversal as we're seeing that oil is stabilizing and that we're seeing that all of a sudden, while there was some drawdowns, not as much as anticipated last week in terms of oil inventories, new rigs are coming on. So we'll see how that plays out in all of this. And we also saw the yuan, as I mentioned, the China has been slowly but surely dropping the value of their currency. We're currently just very slowly and gracefully seeing it at levels we haven't seen in about 5 years. So I think they learned from their devaluation saga when that really threw markets and currencies into a terrible tizzy, that maybe it wouldn't be such a great idea to do a one-shot kind of deal. So instead, they've been slowly but surely dropping the value of that. Now, of course, the weak job numbers that really, really messed with currencies pretty significantly on Friday had the yuan tick up a little bit against the dollar because the dollar dropped against everything. We're going to watch that because I'm not quite sure, again, if the dollar move is going to be sustainable to the downside here with this 4.7% unemployment rate. But nonetheless, kind of interesting to see. Before we get to our guest, I want to mention something that I got some emails in a couple of episodes back. We had talked about the global allocation strategy and our new offering that we are planning. It's going to take a little while, but it's something that is going to be offering our, like a global allocations concept, but with lower minimums, fully advisor assisted, of course. And we have a name for it, eVestology. But if you want information, a couple of people wrote in to me saying, hey, where do I find this? And I mentioned this last time. We're going to put a quick request form on the show notes for this episode. Just put in your name and your email, and you'll get a quick report on our global allocation strategy, just concept and overview, you know, high level look at what we're thinking. And we'll put you on the list to announce when the eVestology offering is going to be coming up so that you're on the list and make sure that you get that. So you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and just quickly fill out the form on the show notes for this episode. And we'll put you on that list for when that comes out, plus send you a report on the global allocation strategies. We're going to get to our guest. When I get back, also I have a couple of stocks I want to talk about, some things we looked at last week that I think are pretty interesting. Of course, there is an overriding question about markets and valuations right now. But from a technical standpoint and clearly from a fundamental standpoint, a couple of stocks, we'll call it the staples area, and one in the biotech, pharmaceuticals, healthcare area that we're going to talk about. But when we get back, we'll talk about that a bit more and a few other things. But right now, let's get to our guest and see what he has to say. And our special guest this week is Ben Hunt from Salient. He writes the wonderful piece called Epsilon Theory, and a couple of real humdingers out recently that I very much enjoyed reading. And you can, of course, get your copy as well. We'll put information on the Disciplined Investor Podcast website under this episode on how to get your copy. Ben, how are you?
I'm doing great. Great to be here again with you. Appreciate it.
You come up with some really, well, I don't want to say crazy like in a negative way, but some very interesting ways of putting your thoughts together in terms of some of the pictures you use and images, as well as the references to various movies and quotes. So really, I know it takes a lot of work.
It does take some time, but it's worth it. I appreciate the kind words.
Well, let's talk about, I want to go back to what you wrote at the beginning of May. You talked about, and you titled this piece, Optical Illusion. Yeah. And one of the things I think that I got from this was the whole idea of, let's take whatever you're thinking and the reasons why things are doing what they are and throw them out the window.
Pretty much. That's not a bad way of putting it. You know, every year I think, well, we can't possibly be in a more policy-driven or policy-controlled investment environment. And then every year I'd wake up and here we are. It's even more policy-driven and policy-controlled. And I tell you, it got me thinking about the power of ideas and theory, because you know what I try to do is try to look at these issues that we face today through the lens of history. Not necessarily investment history, but I was thinking about the history of science, the history of ideas, and it really struck me that much of what I think we're going through in terms in an investment world is in a sense, I think we are operating under the wrong theory. I think that is us as investors, mm-hmm. and but it also is our central bankers and the approaches they're taking to controlling the global economy. And it brought up in this particular note you're talking about, it reminded me of all things of the cholera plagues of the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. And this was obviously before germ theory hadn't been really invented. And so, for example, in the great London plagues in the middle of the 19th century, they were operating under the wrong theory. And what I mean by that was that they had a theory, they didn't know about germs, they called it miasma, bad air. Mm-hmm. Right? So they knew that the disease and the spread of the disease had something to do with human waste, mm-hmm. but they thought it had to do with the smell. Right? Because mm-hmm. if it's a bad smell, that was the reason why you got these periodic plagues. I mean, in 1848, 1849, 75 to 100,000 people died in London.
From a bad smell.
From a bad smell. That's right. And so what was fascinating to me was that their policy response, because they were operating under the wrong theory, was exactly the wrong policy. So what they did, the town, aldermen and councilors, they set up these task forces to go around the city, and basically wherever there was a bad smell, which in mid-19th century London was basically in everyone's basement, mm-hmm. because you just dumped your waste down there. It was like every place had its own little cesspool down there. So what they did was they passed a new law saying, okay, no more dumping of waste in your local cesspool. No, what we want you to do is to dump it down the storm drains because we want it to go into the river. We basically want to get this into the groundwater.
Right. We want to spread it quicker.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And so they had, of course, another great plague just a few years later in 1853. But this time there was this Dr. Jon Snow, no relationship, I think, to the Game of Thrones Jon Snow, but he was really the father of epidemiology. Now, he didn't have game theory either, but what he did was he said, well, I'm going to take a map of London. Something is not right here. Something in the way we're thinking about this isn't right. So he made what I call you can look up the map that he made of London, basically made a dot map superimposed on a street map of London, a dot map of where the deaths were. And what he found was that there was this enormous clustering around a particular water pump, the Broad Street water pump. And in fact, you can go today in London on a Broad Street, they have a statue there where the original water pump stood, because Snow took his map, took this visual representation of, the actual facts, how people were dying and the correlation, if you will, right, between mm-hmm. this water pump and the deaths that were occurring, took it to the local council and said, all right, well, that sounds interesting. Let's take the handle off the water pump. They did that, and the disease almost immediately, that particular plague almost immediately wiped out, went away within a matter of days. Mm-hmm. So, you would think that this would be the happy ending to the story, but no, it took another 20 years before what Snow was saying, that it spread through the water, took hold in the rest of England and then throughout Europe. It took 20 years because they still didn't have germ theory. Within a month or two, they had put the handle back on the Broad Street pump.
Yeah, right.
They went right back to the old way of doing things, even though they had had this experience with it. And it just was so powerful to me to think about this, that without the right theory, and I'll tell you, I think the right theory to use now is game theory, without the right theory to apply to either policy or our own individual reactions to a disease or investment or whatever environment we're in, we always tend to repeat the same mistakes.
Right.
And that's why I felt that little bit of history was so powerful, because I do think we're using the wrong theory today.
Well, but one of the things you talked about there, and obviously bringing this back into the area of finance and what's happening in the world with central banks, which I can then overlay your thought about Jon Snow and the outbreak here and what was being used and what was being thought about that was wrong, is that, first of all, as an investor, I think one of the things you mentioned was that, you listen to what OPEC is doing and what they're not doing. You listen to the oil inventories and what it's not doing. But yet, at the same time, you say, if you look at the correlation of the price of oil, price of equities, and a variety of other things, it all comes back to the U.S. dollar and the trade-weighted dollar valuation, and that's really what's pushing everything at this point.
Yeah, that's exactly right, because the dollar, the trade-weighted dollar, is a representation. It is the direct representation of competitive monetary policies. It's a direct representation of this giant game of chicken that's happening between the Fed and China. It's that's what a currency is. It is the relative strength, interest rates, monetary policy. It's all of that between two specific currencies.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at that trade weighted dollar index, and this is an index the Fed itself came up with, mid-90s as their best representation of what competitive monetary policy looked like, because it takes all of our trading partners, all the countries that the United States imports and exports from, and then it weights them according to how much we trade with them. That's what it means to be, it's called the Broad Trade Weighted Dollar Index. And you can find it anywhere. It's on the Fed. There's Fed sites. It's also on Bloomberg and the like. But they devised this specifically to try to measure, what's really going on with the dollar, and hence our relative monetary policy with the rest of the world. And you look at this, and the inescapable conclusion is that since competitive monetary policies really started in the summer of 2014, that was when Yellen said, we're now going to have a tightening bias, we're going to look to try to raise rates. The rest of the world, particularly Europe, said, not us, we're going to double down on our quantitative easing and our accommodation from monetary policy. From June of 2014 to today, it's crazy how everything is correlated to the dollar going up or the dollar going down. And in exactly the same way that cholera deaths in London in the 1850s were correlated to where you got your water from, our market outcomes today are correlated to what's happening with competitive monetary policy. But as in London in the 1850s, we go about our lives thinking that, oh, no, it's not what the Fed is saying or what's happening in China. It's what's happening with OPEC.
Right.
Or what's happening with the fundamentals of this sector or that sector.
Right.
And I wish it were so. God, I wish it were so, because it was so much
easier to explain.
Easier to explain when
much
matters.
More timely, yeah, because it was the news came out and something moved, but that move may have been just a news-driven move that was temporary. But what's interesting is that if everybody if we were to believe that it is all about the US dollar, one of the things that obviously is wrong is that when you look at Europe or Japan, and you look at what's happening with the global situation or what has happened, they are going against the basic tenet of, hey, if you want the world to be a better place, we have to have a little bit of a lower U.S. dollar. And by you fighting this and trying to say that, no, it's our currency that will make things better if it's lower, you're obviously doing a disservice to yourself and, you know, causing irreparable harm.
Yeah, you know that you're exactly right. But this again is the lesson from history. I think the most appropriate kind of place to look there is in the 1930s, where, for example, in 1930, the U.S. passed the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Bill, right, which was a form of monetary policy, right? It's imposing these tariffs and quotas, impacts currencies. You know, it's impacting it directly in terms of trade as opposed to indirectly with what's happening to your currency. But it's the same thing, same exactly the same thing. And of course, as a result of the U.S. passing this law, every other country passed the same type of law, so that in the end, by 1931, everyone was worse off. It's this, and again, this is why I say that game theory is such a, I think, good lens to see these actions through, a good toolkit to use to apply to it, because this is exactly what happens in this particular game would, you know, be called like it's a form of a prisoner's dilemma game where you say, I'm not going to cooperate. Cooperating would be looking out for everyone, right? But in a prisoner's dilemma, say, I got to take care of myself.
Right.
And it is that sort of myopia, that sort of nearsightedness. It's entirely the rational thing to do, so long as your perspective is on your country, your domestic political situation, which of course is the perspective of every leader, every country's leaders. And the inevitable result from that is that everyone starts to cheat or defect or whatever word, you know, game theoretic word you want to use, and it ends up with us all being worse off. It's that classic beggar thy neighbor,
right,
race to the bottom type of behavior.
But what's interesting is that even if it doesn't work, it seems that some of these central bankers are committed to doing what they do, even with the reality. Now, why I mention that is this week, Mario Draghi came out with some commentary during his rate meeting, if you will, where he didn't do anything. There was no rate change, talking about how they're doing a little bit of this, doing a little bit of that, going to continue on, maybe extended a little bit longer. But what he did say in one of his comments that I found very interesting was that he admitted that the stimulus efforts are not kicking in. There's really been no progress seen from the stimulus efforts at this point. Now, it's not like they just released stimulus last week or the last month or even 6 months ago. And it's not like it was the first round, and it's not like it was just a small amount. We're talking about buying not only sovereign bonds, but also corporates and maybe some other, who knows what they're doing. It's also negative interest rates at this point. And he's saying, well, it's not really kicking in. Like, well, if negative interest rates, which was supposed to be this wonderful thing to force money into the system and buying up essentially an unheard of amount of sovereign bonds to get everybody, you know, yields down, and yields being lower there than they are here, what's it going to take?
Right. Yeah. I'm so glad you pointed this out, because in Europe, they've been doing this. The ECB has been doing this for a little over 2 years now. So negative rates, enormous expansion of asset purchases. Yeah, that's what I was referring to about that June 2014 action. So you're right. Been doing this for 2 years, and inflation expectations, growth, it's had no impact on the real economy. But here's the thing. Here's where it has had an impact. It's had an impact on financial assets, right? The prices of stocks and bonds, and particularly in the prices, particularly in hence the interest rate of sovereign debt. Right, you have Italy, you have Spain, you have Ireland, you have Portugal, all trading at phenomenally low interest rates. It's allowing these countries, it's allowing the status quo political establishment to stay in power and continue to kick the can down the road.
And you know, the other thing is that just talking about game theory and concept of looking at the right, you know, through the right lens.
Yeah.
You know, what is the, what are, just conceptually here, has anybody looked into what the holdings are of the central bankers?
You mean as individuals?
Yes, as individuals.
Yeah. You know, I don't know.
Well, I remember years ago when I was looking at something, you know, I was thinking, you know what does Bernanke have?
Yeah.
And it was something that I was going through, and it's not like from what at the time, this is years ago, I was thinking, well, these central bankers have to have like blind pools like the president. That would seem logical to me, right? Blind trusts or whatever, that they don't know what's being invested and whether it's invested or not, whether it's in bonds or stocks or cash or whatever. I remember seeing something about when they listed assets that he had some kind of a variable annuity with a few $100,000 in it in the equity accounts. And I'm thinking to myself, how is that in a case where a central banker can really affect stock prices? Now, by the way, okay, higher stock prices are good for everybody, not just for him. But still, it seems like there's something kind of wrong here. And who knows at what level many of these individuals throughout the central banks own securities or bonds or whatever they own.
You know, I hear you, but I think that the issue is actually both bigger and
I agree.
And less direct than that. And here's what I mean. Today, since his retirement, Bernanke now sits on the board. He's an advisor to two of the biggest hedge fund families in the world, right? Mm-hmm. The Citadel and to Fortress. Citadel in particular, they're paying him, you know, $1 million to $2 million a year.
Right.
So when they're thinking about what policies do I want to undertake, they are always profoundly status quo oriented, kick the can down the road, because the thing to avoid is the recession, right? To avoid is the problem for the banks and the status quo capital interests, because they're the ones who are going to be writing you the big check when you step down.
Well, right?
It's not what they own today, it's what they're going to own in the future.
Right. But what's interesting is, you know, talking about protecting the banks, we do a very good job here of doing that at all costs, it seems.
Yes, we do.
In Europe, have you seen the banks in Europe since the negative interest rate policy went into place? They're awful. They're back down to 2009 levels.
Well, here's the problem with the European banks, and it's the problem. This is where the event where the catalyst for a big global crack-up is going to come. It's going to come from the European banks. And again, I'll use an example from the 1930s. So in 1930, U.S. passes Smoot-Hawley, other countries respond, global trade declines, just as it is today. Currencies start to go, start to be competitive on currencies, that race to the bottom we're talking about, same as today. The real economy in the U.S. kind of eked along fine, 1930, getting into 1931. In the summer of 1931, one of the biggest banks in Europe, bank called Credit Anstalt, and the irony of this is going to be that Deutsche Bank today is a inheritor of Credit Anstalt from 1931. But in 1931, the bank went belly up. It went belly up because its loan book was dominated by, you know, what we call merchant banking. Right, they were loans to companies that trade around the world and could no longer repay those loans because of the decline in global trade, the protectionism, the impact on currencies and the like. So that was the spark, that was the cause, if you will, of the enormous investment rout that started in the summer of 1931. It was the failure of Credit Anstalt. And that, I tell you, that is going to be the same dynamic when the chickens come home to roost from what's going on today. You've got the enormous banks like Deutsche Bank, one of the, I think it's the third largest bank in the world today. What I'll tell you, my sense is, Deutsche Bank today is insolvent, which is fine. You can be an insolvent bank, particularly in the European context, without it really kind of coming to the fore. But if we get a shock like China floats its currency, the election of a President Le Pen in France in 2017, a shock like some equivalent to Le Pen coming into politics in Germany, which will have their own set of elections in 2017. Deutsche Bank's done for, right? Hmm. It can't survive. And these are the sort of shocks, because the European banks were never recapitalized
right.
to the same extent as the U.S. banks were. And even more to the point, they don't, what we'll call, fund themselves in the same way that U.S. banks do. U.S. banks do have at their root retail deposits.
Right.
Right. That's the source, the source of deposits. How they are funding their assets, their loans, or through the liabilities, their deposits. And that's not how European banks finance themselves, or fund themselves. So I'm convinced that's where the epicenter of the earthquake to come will be. It'll be the European banking system, because we are so fundamentally tied to these issues. It seems to be
going on and happening right now. Listen, I want to skip ahead to the most recent Epsilon theory, and you kind of made some interesting comments here in terms of looking at different stocks and various performance on things like earnings and central bank decision days and things of that nature. And you started talking about this concept of the common knowledge game.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, the basic idea, what really underlies this, is that we're all suckers for a good story, right? As human beings, we're suckers for a good story. And that's always been true in the stock market and investing. And it's particularly true historically, when you think about the stocks, the companies that have a story associated with them. It's typically what we call the TMT sector, the technology, media, or telecom stocks,
mm-hmm.
right? Because these are stocks that don't have perhaps great earnings, right? Their P/E ratio right. could be through the roof, but because they've got a good story, they've got a great technology, or they've got some great idea, or something.
Netflix is a good example.
Yeah, Netflix is a great example, right? So anything that trades at a very high multiple. Look, that multiple could be completely deserved if the story is true. But regardless, we as humans are suckers for a good story.
Yeah.
And I show some examples of that from some technology stocks that I used to both own and short, go long and short when I was running my hedge fund. And what you find with these story stocks is that you often find a CEO or a charismatic leader who will put the story out there with Cramer, after earnings, mm-hmm. Put the story out there with a couple of the sell-side analysts who write a glowing report after earnings. And what happens in these situations, because we don't have fundamentals to really plant your feet as an investor,
mm-hmm.
You end up, there's a pattern to this. Again, it comes out of game theory. It's called the common knowledge game. And essentially what happens is, when you don't have those fundamentals to plant your feet, and you have a very active, what we call in game theory, missionary activity, that's the CEO appearing right. on Cramer, that's yeah. the analyst writing their reports. Even if you think in your heart of hearts, oh, this is a terrible company, I don't believe the story, you have to act as if you do, at least in the very short term. So mm-hmm. these statements have a half-life, you can measure this stuff. End result is, for a lot of these companies, all of their stock movement up happens in the day after earnings. I mean, it's crazy, right? So, those 4 days out of the trading year account for more than 100% of the stock's movement up.
Right,
it's
and that's due to the fact that there's stories going on, there's commentary going on, there's TV appearances that happen, new upgrades that may happen for
that's
a stock,
right.
et cetera.
That's right. And so if for the entire year X those 4 days, the stock is flat or even ekes down over that time period. It's fascinating. But the point of what I was getting at in this most recent piece was that today, all of our stocks are story stocks. It's not the story being told by that charismatic CEO. It's the story being told by our central bankers, our the missionaries, again, to use the game theory word, the politicians and the central bankers. And so you could actually measure this stuff. You know, you measure how much does this stock, this index, S&P 500 index, energy stocks, we care a lot about this in Houston, the MLPs, the pipeline mm-hmm. stocks, how much do they go up, or what's their price performance on the day of the Fed coming out and Janet Yellen giving her pep talk, her press conference, and versus their performance on every other day? And you do this over the last 2 years and over the last 5 years, and it's staggering, right? So you know, one of the examples I use is this. It's called the Alerian MLP Index, mm-hmm. right? So it's, again, you know, we're a Houston-based company, so we've got a big business investing in our mutual funds invest in pipeline companies, right? We're called MLPs.
Right. And Master Limited Partnerships.
That's right. Uh-huh. Most of them are in that format, but really it's basically you're investing in the energy infrastructure
right.
of the U.S., all domestic stuff. So in the last 2 years, if I had gone long, if I had owned this index of 43 pipeline companies on the day of the Fed announcements,
right.
and there were over the last 2 years, there are like 18 of these days, right? I would be up 28%.
Mm-hmm.
If I just started on those days. If owning it on every other day, I'm down 40%.
Mm. Wow,
I mean,
that's
crazy.
Startling.
Absolutely, because you think you're buying these companies on the basis of the company fundamentals, you know, what's going on with oil, what's going on with, you know, energy supply and demand matters not a whit.
So right? It's back to what we've talked about in the beginning, which
yeah.
is this whole idea of looking at what is truly the what we should be looking at and focusing on right now. And again,
that's right.
Times are much different now than they were, let's say, I'm just going to give a timestamp here, 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, where the Fed wasn't as continually vocal as they are. And while they may have been cheerleaders all along, it seems like there's a lot more of it these days, maybe because we need it that much more. Maybe we have a market that's quote-unquote depressed and you need a constant person cheering up the situation here. Whatever it is, I don't know when it's going to end. It doesn't look like it's going to end anytime soon from what I can see in this regard. And the question then is, when does the story change? When does the optics change so that people are no longer so consumed with the Fed, which is obviously the underlying point of a lot of your commentary, because you
yeah.
have a big frustration with the Fed
I do.
And central banks. It's obvious.
Yeah,
right?
But I have to live in the world as it is, right?
Right. Well, of course.
We have to... You know, we can't hide under a rock. We still have to invest and stay engaged in the world as it is. So I just think it's important to pay attention to what matters. And today it seems that really the only thing that matters, again, is this competitive monetary policy and the way it's described by the missionaries. But so you ask, you know, how long does it last? What changes it? Well, it can't really change until, because the root problem of all of this and the reason why, you're right, it's necessary for the Fed and the central banks to be taking these actions, both with their words and with their policies, is because, as in the 1930s, we have an overwhelming amount of debt sloshing around in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And what changes it is getting out of debt. And unfortunately, there are only three ways to get out of debt. You can grow your way out, which everybody wants to do, but we're so far in debt, it just...
Very difficult.
It seems almost impossible,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Even for the United States, which is the closest to be able to achieve that. Second is to inflate your way out of debt,
mm-hmm.
which is what that's why the central bankers are talking about, trying to encourage inflation. But ultimately, the only thing that's really going to get you out of debt is to assign losses, which is a very painful process, and in a sense clear the decks, right? That is really the only thing that ultimately allows for return of fundamentals mattering, of the animal spirits, if you will, that both allow stocks to go down but can also make stocks go up. Because right now we're in a situation where it's what I call kind of the long gray slog, where the debt we've built up is pulled forward all of this economic activity, so there's no engine for growth going forward. But at the same time, they can continue to do this to try to prevent any sort of politically shocking decline in markets.
Right. Well, I mean, at the end of the day, the third option, they're not going to allow. Which not can be seen.
So what sparks that third option is always a realigning election. Sometimes that's mm-hmm. by the ballot box. Sometimes that's by the power of a coup or something like that. But that is ultimately what changes things around, these realigning elections, which is why I think it's so important to think about what's going to change both here in the United States this November, what's going to happen in France and Germany in 2017, and of course the political pressure that the Chinese regime is under right now.
Let me just switch it up real quickly and ask you something. Is the reason why some things these days are overlooked and why there is certain activity that's allowed that may be to the long-term detriment of investing in financial systems because of this, well, we'll cheat and cut corners any way we can as long as things are good? For example, this whole non-GAAP earnings guidance I mean, this whole non-GAAP thing is like me saying, just to let you know, I'm a company and we had great earnings. We reduced our expenses and, you know, you could read the information if you want, but, you know, don't look at all that. I'm just telling you, we did fine.
Yeah.
I mean, what is this all about and when is it going to end? And who allows non-GAAP? It's crazy, isn't it?
Well, we allow it, right? There's nothing that requires any of us investors to go along with it, right? So the classic example of non-GAAP earnings, and I use this as an example within the note I wrote. You know, this company, it's a huge company. It's a mega cap tech company, Salesforce.com, right? Mm-hmm. So $55 billion market cap. They've never had GAAP earnings in ever, right? Not in the life of the company, and really it's because the difference between GAAP and non-GAAP earnings is that they issue so much stock to themselves and to compensate their employees, particularly their sales employees, that whatever, you know, revenues they bring in, they're compensating their salespeople to bring in unprofitable revenue. And then the stock expenses are factored into a GAAP expense but not into the non-GAAP. So they say, well, just ignore all the stock we're issuing to ourselves and ignore the fact that the sales that we're doing are not profitable. Look how much we are growing our non-profitable revenues.
Right.
But look, there's nobody holding a gun to you know, an investor's head and saying, oh yeah, give me some of that. But that is exactly what we as investors have done, because like I say, we're humans, we love a good story. We love a good story, and there's some great storytellers out there. Historically, it's been kind of individual companies and leaders and the like, and so they do well for a time, and ultimately, you know, they don't, right?
Yeah.
But today, the storytellers are our central bankers and our politicians, because they, too, are trying to say, you know, look over here, not over there. Let's try to focus on what's positive, because if you focus on what's not, then this whole kind of house of cards comes down.
Yeah, it falls down. Well, Ben Hunt, I appreciate it, from Salient, writing the Epsilon Theory papers on a regular basis. You can find all that information on this episode's show notes for The Disciplined Investor. Ben, always great talking to you. I appreciate you coming aboard today.
I appreciate you having me. Always
all right.
A pleasure.
All right. Thanks so much. Have a good one.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Now, as I mentioned, if you want to get the information from Ben, his Epsilon Theory newsletter, we'll have some links over on the show notes for this episode at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Before we went to discuss the fascinating commentary of Ben and, of course, his common knowledge game and game theory and all of the things that he talks about that are kind of, I think, fascinating at least, I mentioned that when we came back, we'd talk about a few stocks. And I just want to mention two stocks that we've been looking at that I think are kind of interesting. One is Acorn. Acorn, AKRX, is the symbol. And Acorn is involved in the pharmaceutical business. They do a lot of ophthalmology type of drugs and generics, et cetera. They had some problems. They were late filing some of their forms. But if you take a look at the chart, especially the daily chart, you'll notice that it attempted a breakout on Friday from a significant consolidation range where above the level that they are at the current time, there is a bit of an opening, a hole we'll call it, where there is an opportunity for a short squeeze to happen if we see the continuation potentially of the biotech rally from the bottoms that we saw several months ago continue on if we get some legs from there. The company has a really good overall fundamentals. The earnings growth and revenue growth are excellent. Margins are expanding. We see some really good things in terms of the underlying fundamentals, which is, of course, an important component of a long-term growth story for a company. Now, again, they had some problems due to the generics, which we've seen many times. The potential for, I would say, for a roll-up or some M&A activity for a buyout of this company is, I think, relatively high and relatively good. There's a lot of things they have that may be very good to add to the portfolio of some of the big players out there. But nonetheless, again, if we see a little bit of a break, a bit higher from these levels, I would say probably about 31.5, which is not too far from here, is really a open area. But really, we're talking about a 1.5% increase from where we are currently. As it closed last week, there is an opportunity for a breakout. We'll see if that resistance holds and if, in fact, there is some pressure on the downside. But this is something we'd be looking at as an opportunity for a midterm situation. The other one is Sprouts Farmers Market, which if you've been following the saga of many of the companies in the area of groceries and retail, that obviously Whole Foods Market is under a significant amount of pressure due to just a whole host of things. People looking for lower cost alternatives on the organic side. And we have also Fresh Market, who had a lot of problems and then was actually bought out by private equity, went private. And Sprouts Farmer Market, again, is one of these that I find very interesting, that it has a very significant and solid fundamental backdrop of continuation of earnings growth and things of that nature. However, the company has been quite punished. Now, the stock itself is seeing a very different pattern that we talk about from with regard to Acorn, where Acorn is kind of in a potential breakout point, where Sprouts, symbol SFM, is, I would say, bouncing on the low and the potential for a basing pattern. Now, what you like to see in there is the basing happen over a little time and then a bounce start to happen off of that base, off a very defined base technically. And when you see that, there is an opportunity to start legging into the position. Now, usually what is really the best way, if you could theoretically find the stock and invest in a way, if you have good fundamentals as a backdrop and then you find a position that maybe a stock has been overdone to the downside for whatever reason and is starting a bit of a turnaround, to leg in off of a consolidation that has a very, very strong base and the stock just won't get underneath that. It starts to move up, and then once you get the breakout point where there is above some previous highs, then you add to that position and bring yourself up to a full position, whatever that may be for your portfolio. So two different looks, two different scenarios, both again with really good fundamentals, but something that we're looking at and I thought I would just bring to your attention. Anyway, again, if you want the information on the global allocations and the upcoming offering of eVestology, which is the first time we mentioned that actually right now, so you're the first to hear it, check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com and go over to the show notes for this episode. You can get some information on that. And of course, if you've got any questions at all in the future, just write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for joining me this week. I hope you have a great week. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented agreement that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.